Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, I'm joined by Catherine Mangu Ward. She's the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine's print edition. Catherine, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
And I'm joined also by Matt Welch, editor-at-large of Reason. Thank you, Matt, for talking to us.
Hello from Park Slope.
Do you go to the park there much, Matt?
Because it's lousy with rats. It is a very historically interesting park. It's where the Brooklyn Dodgers, back when they're called like the trolley cars or whatever.
Or the Superbos, I believe.
The Superbos had their clubhouse, and it's a site of probably the most significant skirmishing in the Revolutionary War. But I don't want to like go off on the tangent here. I just want to say that, you know, New York doesn't get its due as being an important Revolutionary War battlefield, mostly because we're a bunch of English-loving sellouts.
Yeah, well, and of course, we all know which state was called the crossroads of the Revolution. New Jersey, of course. I'll answer for everyone, because that's where more battles, more fighting took place than anywhere. But of course, New Jersey doesn't get its due, because people are jealous of it. Before this goes off into a steep ravine into a really terrible version of Schoolhouse Rock, Catherine, one of the most stunning developments, and in a way it was both uplifting and depressing, I think, developments of last week was Justin Amash, Representative Justin Amash from Michigan, actually missing a vote. What happened there, and why should we care?
So I will start by saying I recognize in myself a fondness for Justin Amash, which almost certainly signals that he is going to do something horrifically authoritarian in the next 6 to 8 weeks. Whenever I start to really feel pro an elected official, they're about to let me down in a super serious way. So let's go ahead and stipulate that it's all going to end in tears. But Justin Amash has made it to 4,189 votes. He had never missed a vote. He was actually talking with reporters just outside the chamber when they closed a vote on one of the elements of the, he was talking about the Obamacare repeal and replace stuff. Scampered in there. It was a little bit too late. Politico reported that he cried. He reports he is not a crybaby and totes didn't cry. We will let readers imagine this as they desire, or listeners imagine this as they desire. But he tweeted out to his district that he was sorry. And it is a little bit of a sad day.
Well, we know whether or not he cried, we can be sure that in political cartoons covering this, that Lady Liberty is crying.
And each one of his tears will be labeled with a specific bill, I think.
Yes.
In the cartoon.
Matt, what is your, I think we're all admirers of Amash's legislative record. What do you think about, what do you think about him as an example and the types of, not just in his, kind of Lou Gehrig, Pete Rose ability to, crack 4,000. What was the hit record? It was like 4,192, I think.
That is correct.
When Rose broke it. But so Amash came very close to being the Pete Rose of the House, U.S. Congress, which is maybe not the best way to commemorate somebody. But what is it about Amash that that you find admirable and worthy of respect?
One part of this record has just been he doesn't want to be absent from the floor in case they try some kind of voice vote shenanigans to change the way that the NSA and other security outlets of the government can surveil us, which is pretty great. So he's like played defense constantly. He wants to be close to the floor in case they ever try shenanigans specifically for that. I think Amash is a really interesting figure right now. He's separate from Thomas Massie. They're like best bros in the House and possibly the two most libertarian congressmen. Massie is much more on the Trump train, does not play well with others. Like, he doesn't join all the committees. Amash has been key to the Freedom Caucus and in leading the coup against Speaker John Boehner and these things. So he's been an organizational figure of some importance and heft. And it's been interesting to watch him in the era of Trump. He has absolutely embraced, been way out in front of being an outspoken critic of the Trump administration, much more than say Rand Paul in the Senate, although Rand Paul has criticized plenty, not everything, but plenty. But he clearly is embracing that role. And what makes it interesting to me as well is that he's now, I think, 36 years old. He clearly has political ambitions that far outstrip his current job. I wouldn't be surprised if he's pondering at least the idea that he might primary Donald Trump in 2020. It would not surprise me at all if he was doing that. Another thing that he's doing that's really worthy of note is that in an era where Republicans are in Congress are dutifully completely switching spaces with their Democratic counterparts from 2009, which is to say they are running screaming from any possible constituent town hall because they're afraid that people are going to yell at them over a healthcare legislation. And also they're blaming, you know, outside AstroTurf for agitating and these kind of things. In that era, Amash is doing town hall after town hall in Michigan, and they're huge. And he's getting pretty boffo reviews, even as, you know, he's taking a lot of slings and arrows from people in places like Ann Arbor. But people appreciate that kind of openness. So he's a really interesting figure to watch, especially right now.
Yeah, and I know for me, one independent of his specific positions, which I tend to agree with, I grant that up front. But the fact that he continues to explain his votes on his Facebook page in language that I understand, and I've gone there more than once to have a law that, you know, when you're looking at legislation and you're not quite sure what it's doing or what a yes or a no vote means, I love the fact that he's been totally transparent about what he sees as the stakes of a particular piece of legislation, and here is why he voted this way or that or the other way. And I almost think that should be mandatory among Congress people. It's a bracing example. I'm not sure if, and I realize, you know, as a baby boomer, it's a different story. Maybe Gen Xers and millennials can get behind somebody named Justin as president. For me, it's a little too boy band, but, you know, I'm aging out. I understand that now. Catherine, one of the things that Amash, along with the libertarian leaning members of the Republican Party and some many in the Democratic Party as well, have been great about surveillance and about government and state surveillance. They have a sensitivity to it. Trump has recently been charging that Barack Obama sicked the NSA or the CIA or the FBI or the Alcohol Beverage Commission of New York to surveil his building and to tap his phones. Or what's going on there? Do we know the latest on that? And also, we're now learning, and this kind of makes sense, that the Internet of Things and our smart TVs are actually kind of nosy neighbors.
Right. So, I mean, I think there's this, the latest moment of this is Kellyanne Conway saying on the Sunday shows that when she mentioned that televisions and microwaves could be used to surveil people's homes, she did not mean to imply that Obama had commissioned various U.S. departments, agencies, dog catchers to employ those technologies to surveil Trump Tower. She just mentioned it proximate to that discussion, and why are people always putting words in her mouth? So, you know, at this point, everyone has agreed that those allegations seem to have been made without Trump or Conway possessing any specific evidence. It doesn't mean that there isn't evidence, which is a sort of weird, we have like a weird Schrodinger's microwave problem here.
I just want the soup to be hot, but
yeah,
not too
and you know what?
It
never will be in
out.
The microwave. The microwave is a lie in that. But I, you know, I think that there's this weird split that's happening on this conversation where for some people it's a conversation about privacy. Oh, well, shouldn't libertarians say that this is terrible because it shows that nobody has any privacy and everyone can be spied on? And of course, you know, we are against that, and we're, you know, Justin Amash is against that. But at the same time, I think the expectation of privacy for elected officials or officials serving in political office should frankly be very, very minimal. And in the Flynn case, of course, it was a gray area because he, you know, maybe he wasn't serving at that moment. Same with the Trump thing. But I, for one, am fine with public officials having virtually no privacy, particularly when they are performing any kind of professional function. So it's a weird debate with weird edges, and the Trump administration seems to be valiantly striving to make it weirder every minute of every day.
Matt, do you have a lot of concerns about, and I guess, that, you know, as Catherine was pointing out, there's at least two or three broad issues here. One is the state surveilling normal citizens without warrants or without any real suspicion all of the time. And we know that they have the capacity to do that. To the extent that the government or some agencies are doing that is unclear at any given point. Then there's the question of public officials and what kind of privacy they might have. And then there's that third part, which probably is ultimately more important, which is everything that can take a command from us, whether it's our cell phone or our TVs or our, Amazon speaking tubes and all of that, can also listen in. And there's that fascinating murder case where an Alexa device, a voice recorder, a command recorder in a home, may have captured information that is material to a murder that took place. That is being sussed out right now. How do you kind of rank these or put these in perspective for yourself?
Barry Friedman from I believe NYU just came out with a book called "Unwarranted Policing Without Permission," which I think frames the issue really well in terms of what's a higher ranked authority of things that we should be worried about. And to me, it's that nexus between what technology can do and then what police, the government, and others can do with that without explicitly receiving authorization for it. Barry Friedman makes the argument, and I'm not sure I totally agree with it, that the solution is kind of more democratization. We need more democratic deliberation about the use of cell phone stingray towers, for example, that local police departments are using and lying about using constantly. It is those things that I care about more, like the CIA WikiLeaks stuff that came out the other day, to the extent that I understand them, and you two in particular know how much I do not understand about technology, but it seemed to me a confirmation of something that we knew, which is that, of course, the CIA, like all intelligence agencies out there, are looking for ways to get around encryption. They hate encryption, and so they're looking for tools. But the tools that were enumerated, at least the ones that I was aware of and reading our own coverage of it, were the kinds of things that it wasn't a mass surveillance system. It wasn't scooping up everybody's information and keeping it somewhere and being able to access it the day they decide that Nick Gillespie is the problem. Realize that Nick Gillespie is the problem. So for me, that's the higher order of trouble. That and some of the unsettled areas of law, like third-party doctrine, the fact that as soon as we have relationships with our internet service providers, cell phone companies, banks especially, right now there's kind of a standing assumption on the part of law enforcement that all that stuff is – they can have it. They can have access to it, and that we should know better than to sign over our records. Well, hopefully – and again, Barry Friedman's book is really good about suggestions legally on how to get there. Hopefully we'll get to a place where the Supreme Court will start – addressing this and giving clawing back some kind of Fourth Amendment guarantees against our own, what we consider to be our own papers, our own things, effects from the assumption that law enforcement can get their grubby fingers in it. Other than that, put a tape on your little camera on your laptop and that kind of stuff and hope for the best. I just don't want the cops to be able to rummage through everything automatically as a permanent database that they can access.
So hope for the worst, but read the Daily Mail every day for the worst celebrity gossip gets hacked through all of that kind of stuff. Catherine, you're a kind of forward adopter of various technologies. Do you have any of those Amazon Echo type devices in your house? I'm not even sure what happens. I have an Android phone and I use the speech, to voice recognition for various things. I'm not even sure how, I guess that just goes into the records as a, if it's on your map or whatever, if Google Maps, but do you think about that ever? I mean, do you kind of choke up sometimes when you're asking for a song to play automatically, and you realize, holy shit, this could be used against me.
So I do not have one of these Amazon devices in my house for the highly specific reason that my daughter is named Alexa.
Yeah.
So constantly hollering at Alexa to do things is that's basically like that's 80% of the conversation in my house.
Yeah, and that will be the cutting edge of child abuse cases. Right,
yeah. I
wasn't yelling at her. I was trying to get that Celine Dion song to play.
I just needed some more laundry detergent. Yeah. So first of all, screw you, Amazon, for getting up in my kid's name, and I will never buy your product. Second, I am totally unconcerned. I am absolutely on the other end of the spectrum of this. Of course, it sucks that there is basically no way to build a bulwark between giving every single piece of my private information that ever existed to Google, which I very much want to do. I want them to know everything about me because my memory is already failing and I want to outsource it to like a server farm somewhere in the floating in the middle of the ocean, like containing every bit of human knowledge. But, you know, the sort of stuff that's coming out about the TVs, I think in particular, has been a little bit overblown. In that case, you have to be physically present to turn on that function. Now, of course, there are lots of ways the government spies on us, and they suck. But the Samsung smart TV thing that everyone lost their minds about, all it is actually saying intelligence agencies have the ability to plant a bug in a place where they physically have an agent, which, you know, they already did. In this case, the bug is software inside your TV, but it's not that substantially different. So, you know, to my mind, the most important political element here is to try and figure out ways to throw up judicial bulwarks between the giant amount of data that private companies have and what the public sector has access to. I'm not optimistic about that, but I do think there's a huge upside to no privacy that people frequently discount when they're in the mood
to
panic.
And at Reason, we've written about the upside of zero privacy. I think that's actually almost a literal title of a story that we ran years ago when we had our personalized cover, where 40,000 subscribers got an issue that had an image of their mailing address, a high quality satellite photo, and then we had some material in the magazine on the front and back covers tailored directly to their congressional address, their zip code, and whatnot. I am intrigued, Catherine, by the idea of Google having all of my memories. And then, you know how in Google Photos, like they'll improve your photo automatically. Like, can they do that with our memories, where you send it out there, but then you pay a small fee and you get memories back that are better than the ones that you actually had?
I want Instagram filters on my world perception in real time.
Totally.
That's correct.
This is not science fiction. I saw a reference on Twitter, so it must be true, about 5 days ago I think it was a Wall Street Journal science column talking about how the way that we're using our devices and the internet and our iPhones is changing cognition on some level. And one of the areas, especially where that it hits, is memory. And we are outsourcing, literally our brains are kind of outsourcing memory now, because we don't require to know how to do all these sort of functions that we did before. And that's changing how we adapt, which is a great reason to take a bong rip and see what's going on.
Though we should also note that this objection goes back literally to Socrates. Like, Socrates was worried that the practice of writing things down would ruin our brains. So, you know, it's okay if we're changing our memories permanently.
Yeah, it's changing them, whether it's a decline or not, I think, is a question. But I know from some of my readings and some stories I did actually like 20 years ago about the use of repressed memories in lawsuits and whatnot. One of the Freud and the kind of first modern era of psychology, it was all predicated upon the idea that your brain was a tablet, or like what Freud would call a magic tablet, one of those plastic sheets with a black thing behind it, and you could write on, you could doodle on it and then pull the sheet up and it would disappear, but it would leave a trace on the tablet below that your brain was like that tablet, like everything that happened to you left a physical trace that couldn't be eradicated or changed. And sometime after World War II, Psychologists realize that that your mind and particularly memories are very plastic, that they're constantly kind of being rolled up into a new ball and then, you know, reshaped by a lot of things, including context and suggestion. And it was fascinating in the context of repressed memory cases because what was working in the therapy field to get people to get on with their lives and live after some type of trauma also sometimes crossed into courtrooms where they were making false accusations against people.
Before we change the subject, just to throw out a recommendation, if people are interested in this kind of the student dorm room conversation that we're having, there's a great book by Timothy Garton Ash, the preeminent sort of modern historian of Central Europe and the post-communist revolutions. He had been a student in East Berlin in like 1968 or thereabouts, and sort of fell in love, and that kind of inspired his whole career and interest in this subject. And so after all the files came out, he's like, oh, let's go look at my file. So he wrote a book called The File, and it's not a very well-known book, but it's a great meditation on what we think we remember. And then he goes back and he re-interviews people because he discovers like his girlfriend was actually reporting on him to the secret police, the Stasi. It's just a marvelous book all about memory, surveillance, and totalitarianism. It's great.
Yeah, no, and I mean at the national or level, it's, you know, obviously we change our understanding of America and of American history. Other countries do it in more or less explicit ways. It's really kind of a fascinating process, and with the technology, and Catherine, this echoes something you were saying. It's technology really ends up determining not the best policies, but it's kind of like that's the reality we live in, and then it's up to us to kind of figure out how to deal with it. And I'm more comfortable than I should be, I think, with privacy eroding or what we grew up as privacy is eroding a bit, because I think people will kind of incorporate in the fact that we probably are going to end up knowing too much about each other in our daily lives, and then you just rank order. When somebody is doing something really awful, that's one thing, but all of the kind of petty traits of humanity that will come out when, you know, WikiLeaks dumps all of Reason's emails and things like that. Well, you know, we'll just discount those and get on with things.
Hope so.
I hope so too. And by the way, nothing in this conversation should be taken to mean that we won't mount vigorous legal defenses against each other.
Correct.
When the time comes. But speaking of surveillance and people who are going down the memory hole, there is, Matt, you might want to talk about Preet Bharara, the U.S. attorney, federal prosecutor, who in 2015 took some action against Reason. He has recently he's in the Southern District of New York, very high profile guy, very camera ready guy, as are all of the people who fill that role. But he has been fired by Donald Trump. Talk a little bit about Preet and his relationship with Reason.
So I don't really mean to shit where I eat, or at least where I occasionally dine, but I was on MSNBC this morning. We were talking about the Preet case. So he and 46 or 45 other U.S. attorneys were dismissed from their jobs. Probably an equal number had resigned already. This happens in every administration. They change over. These are political appointees. Janet Reno famously fired like 95 out of 96 of the U.S. attorneys at the moment that they overtook, Clinton took over in 1992. Preet's the only one we're reading about. How odd is that? So I'm there on MSNBC, and there's a nice woman from The New Yorker talking, and she repeated a line that I've seen also in The New York Times of like, you know what? The thing about Preet is she's just so non-political. It should be a professionalized office, just kind of above politics. So that's what's really disturbing about this. Like, what are you even talking about? That job, as you rightly point out, Nick, is famously filled with people who want to be as political as any single U.S. attorney in the country. You're covering Wall Street. You've got this incredible nest of corruption in New Jersey and New York, and political corruption. And Preet Bharara, the good thing about him is that he was investigating political corruption from Bill de Blasio through the New York State governance structures and strictures. So that was really nice about him. What's not nice about him is that this camera-loving, glory hog, self-appointed something or other, he went after us and our commenters because of a case where we were covering the sentencing on The kid who got strung up on Bitcoin.
Ross Ulbricht.
Ross Ulbricht. Sorry for mind blanking here. And our commenters are a vigorous bunch of ne'er-do-wells. And some people said things like the judge who sentenced Ross Ulbricht longer than was recommended by the prosecution and was a total jerk about it. And so I think Brian Doherty wrote a blog post and commenter said things like, well, I hope that, you know, that she rots in hell or a cold day in hell. Someone mentioned wood chippers at some point. It's clearly hyperbolic language. He subpoenaed the information from us about every possible identifying information about these commenters. And then immediately or near immediately slapped a gag order on us so that we couldn't even acknowledge outsiders asking us like, hey, did you guys get subpoenaed on your things? And it was obvious that there's no way in hell this is going to lead to any kind of criminal prosecution. It was just a total petty harassment done in the service of kind of broing out or you know, covering the back of a judge who'd been called mean names on a comments section of a libertarian weblog. So I am not weeping for Preet. Preet is not above politics. He is politics. He's heavy-handed. He's self-glorifying. And there's nothing to suggest in all this transaction, as far as we know, that there's anything special about this case, except for he made a louder stink than the other 45 people who got shit canned.
Yeah, he he was asked to resign, and he did not. And then he tweeted a couple days ago that he didn't resign and that he was fired. And he wrote, and I'm quoting from his tweet, being the U.S. attorney in Southern District of New York will forever be the greatest honor of my professional life. So in that sense, if that's the peak, welcome to the valley, Preet. But, you know, the gag order on us, it was kind of a fascinating story. And it was good when that happened, how many people in the press understood that by subpoenaing the comments of six people or the identifying information from us, which was the first time we'd ever been approached by a government agency to deliver material, that it was it had a chilling effect, or it, whether it was designed to, it certainly did. If the government starts asking you for information about commenters over whom we have no control, we have a small registration process, but they're attacking the press as well as those commenters and chilling speech. And one of the funny things about it, of course, as you pointed out, Matt, was that they sent us the subpoena without a gag order, and so we talked with the people who were the targets of it and said, hey, are you guys planning any action against this and seeing what they were doing or telling them about what we were going to do, which is we were going to have to comply with the gag order. But then Ken White, the great former federal prosecuting attorney who works at Popat Blog and is a lawyer out in California, got in touch and he was like, hey, are you under a gag order? By that time, and I remember when I talked to him, I was like, you know, I really have nothing to say about that, which is also peculiar because that means obviously you're under a gag order and things took off from there. But this is the press reality of the government going after comments and going after publications. So it's nice to see him go.
And one of the things that we learned that people should always be aware of is that there's the subpoena power, particularly of U.S. attorneys and prosecutors, and then even more so if it's a grand jury subpoenas. Of course, grand juries were set up to protect against overweening governments and fishing expeditions, and they ended up enabling them. But you really have no good defense against a subpoena. They just compel you to testify, and you cough up information, and you got to do it. It really, really sucks to be on the receiving end of it.
The other thing that was hilarious, too, is that the pretext was that these commenters who were saying things like, I hope there's a place in hell for her to rot, and then a bunch of people made jokes kind of off of the Fargo meme about, do you put people in a wood chipper head first or toe first, and all of that kind of stuff. But the pretext was that this was a true threat against a sitting federal judge, and they were like, hey— But then the federal prosecutors were like, and you've got 8 days to get us that information, because, you know, they were so worried that this judge was being threatened that they were going to be like, you know what, it's almost the weekend. We'll give you through next week to get us the, you know, it was a joke. I mean, obviously, it's just an exercise in kind of brutishly pushing people around because you could.
Now, and also an exercise in currying favor. I mean, it's pretty clear that the only reason that they would have been looking at that blog post in the first place and gone after it so aggressively and quite quickly, I mean, you know, I love Reason as much as anyone, but I somehow doubt that Preet Bharara was like avidly reading each comment as it was going live, just of his own discretion. But he was, you know, he was looking to score points with the judge that he does business with, and you know, the fact that Trump brought him into Trump Tower during the transition to ask him to stay is the other reason that people are now paying attention to his firing. And they're taking it weirdly as evidence of his moral rectitude. You know, anybody who was marched through the door of Trump Tower to be asked to stay, you know, that wasn't because Donald Trump heard that this guy was a really upright, non-political character. I don't know what was going on there, but I find it weird that you would take that as evidence of his non-political nature, that he managed to finagle time in the spotlight a la Chuck Schumer during that, both during the transition and then when he was asked to leave along with, you know, two dozen other people to somehow make this.
Yeah, and his purity of soul and action. You had reported on his conversation with Trump during the transition. And again, this is we've seen this in other cases where the standard operating procedure is that a new administration clears out a lot of political appointees. Matt, I think you wrote interestingly about that having to do with some State Department officials. But every time Trump does something, it is, you know, the sign that Mussolini is marching closer to the river and about to cross back into Rome and like Caesar. Catherine, you know, what one of the related topics to the Bharara story, though, is that this apparently is one of the slowest transitions in terms of staffing up people. I remember hearing this story very much with the with Bill Clinton's first administration. Is the transition moving slowly, and is that a strategy, or is it a sign of that they're really thinking things through, or is it just incompetence? And we've got various kinds of Obamacare-related repeals coming up, not just in the laws, but in various deadlines. But is the pace of the transition before we get a fully ensconced Trump administration, is this a concern for us?
I think in some ways the panicking about the pace of the transition is quite similar to the kerfuffle around the request for the resignations. It's something that people are in the mood to freak out about because they want Trump to be especially evil. He is filling some of these roles more slowly. He also seems to be, though, he's putting up names and then struggling to get them confirmed because of congressional dysfunction. And, you know, this is a classic blame-shifting maneuver that now happens almost as a matter of ritual at the beginning of every new administration. I'm doing my best to fill these roles, says the president. Well, if you sent us decent people, it wouldn't be so hard to approve them, says the Congress. Repeat, repeat, repeat. So, yeah, I think some of these roles are being filled more slowly than usual in an objective sense. When I was down in Mexico City, people were talking about how when Tillerson and Kelly were down there, that they had no briefing binders or that the briefing binders were much less comprehensive than usual. Again, that's the sort of thing that people love to catastrophize and rumor monger. Maybe it wasn't true. I certainly didn't in the end see it reported in any reputable sources. But it's true, there's no deputy undersecretary for Mexican affairs or whatever, right? And I think this is also part of the broader conversation where even people who are generally hostile to gigantic lumbering states are saying, you know, it's not actually a terrible idea to have a few people with expertise weigh in before you, for instance, issue an executive order banning travel from 7 countries. So, you know, I find myself in the weird position of occasionally advocating for more stability and continuity lately, which is indeed an odd place to be. So, yeah, I think it is going slower than usual. I also don't think it matters as much because it's not clear to me that Trump is going to consult people in those roles, even if they were peopled.
Matt, what kind of folders, briefing folders, do you envision them as being kind of like a trapper keeper portfolio, mm-hmm. or more of a old style, the classic 3-ring binder?
Binders full of women.
With a hard.
Where's the binders full of women? Remember those?
That I'm sure is probably up online somewhere in a 4chan discussion group. So
I think it's like the ones that he wheeled out for his great transition press conference about his business conflicts of interest. They're in the Manila folders, just stuffed with blank paper. Kind of like the Amazon best-selling book right now, which is like why you should vote for Democrats. It's all blank and people are buying it because like, yeah. I think that's what it is. No, part of this should be seen as a subset of Trump's very interesting war against the administrative states. And I should retire that analogy. Sorry. But that's actually the words used by Politico and New York Times and elsewhere in news articles to describe this. He is not going to cut the sources of 87% or whatever the number is of the federal budget, which is to say Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, defense, military, and debt. None of that is he going to cut. So he's trying to squeeze everything out, and he's going to release his budget this week, budget blueprint. All the squeezing is going to be done out of the executive branch, non-defense discretionary spending, which is to say not much. And he needs Congress to buy in. Like he wants to cut EPA by 24%, I think it is. But he will need Congress to say, yes, I am going to affirmatively vote to reduce regardless of what you think of it, it's a popular agency. I'm going to reduce the funding for that. I'm not sure that's going to happen. But he has said, and the administration officials have said, that one of the reasons why they're dragging their feet on some appointments are like, screw it. This doesn't really matter that much. And we should have far fewer employees in the federal government than we do. We should have far fewer regulators and regulations. He's said that we're going to kill two regulations for every one that we adopt. That's physically impossible. However, it's an interesting aspiration to discuss. And we've had quite a few people in my reporting on this positing that he could easily and quickly become the most deregulatory president that we have. So I think it's within this subset of activity that he's doing. And it'll be interesting to see not just how much follow through he has with that. And I think it's going to be a lot. I think as someone who's tried to build stuff over his career, he's sensitive to red tape that gets in the way. And unfortunately, that can go in a good way and a bad way. The good way is let's cut the red tape. The bad way is let's grease wheels to do deals and also have Buy American provisions. There's ways that Donald Trump is going to be a re-regulator, employment contracts to prove that everybody is an American citizen. There's a whole bunch of different ways that that could be bad. However, what he's doing right now with his approach to the administrative state and to deregulation writ large is legitimately very, very interesting, and not least of which because Democrats, when faced with this, they are just kind of in this undifferentiated hysteria. For them, it's all the same. Betsy DeVos equals Jeff Sessions, even when she just doesn't in terms of scope and in terms of what it could mean. And, you know, we're seeing the Food and Drug Administration right now. He just nominated Scott Pruitt, who's former FDA.
Scott Gottlieb.
Sorry for that. Too many Scots. I think we can all agree about that. Who is someone who has called for some pretty interesting regulatory / free market reform at the FDA for a long time. That could have a potential impact of saving a lot of lives. So it's a great thing for us to follow and just to follow in general what this administration is doing. And I think there's a lot of positive upside associated with it.
I will also note there are 1,200 positions that require Senate confirmation in any given administration, that actually is quite mind-boggling, right? If in case you're ever like, why doesn't the Senate seem to get anything done? Apparently part of the answer is because they have to confirm 1,200 positions. The Washington Post has a great tracker where they looked at 553 key positions. 511 of them are still awaiting nominations. 24 nominations are awaiting confirmation, and 18 have been confirmed. Now, that sounds ridiculously low, but it actually is basically comparable to where the past four presidents have been at this point. Obama had 42 sent to the Senate and 28 confirmed by now. Bush had 22 sent and 19 confirmed. So, you know, I think it's true that the place that the bulk of these nominees are in the process is further back. But in terms of actual roles filled by now, Trump is not comparatively looking so bad.
And then do all of the, if you get confirmed by the Senate, they then you go to Applebee's and you have a birthday celebration where you get a piece of cake and all that?
Yes, that's part right. That's part of the slowdown,
really. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's you know, it's those rituals that help bind us together as a country. And that's something that Steve King, the former representative from Iowa, who really hates immigrants, and he probably, you know, to be fair to him, he probably hates people from Nebraska and other football schools that regularly kick the shit out of Iowa as well. But he has been in the news, and this is partly related to Trump. He's a big Trump supporter because Trump is anti-immigrant. Steve King was famously anti-immigrant. He talked about Mexicans coming with cantaloupe. calves the size of cantaloupes because they would carry 100-pound or 500-pound bales of marijuana while they swam across the Rio Grande and whatnot. He is now talking up, or over the weekend, he was talking up how, you know, there's a lot of wisdom in the words of the Dutch nativist politician Geert Wilders. Matt, what is your sense of both? Why is King – does King speak for anybody in America or the Trump administration? And what are the larger issues here? Because you were right. I absolutely agree with you that Trump on a certain level has the ability to become the most deregulatory president ever. I mean, forget, you know, even Jimmy Carter or Ronald Reagan. But is it going to be purchased you know, at the cost of, well, you can deregulate a lot in the United States, but God forbid you actually want to hire somebody who comes from another country, or you want to sell something outside of the, or you want to build a car in Mexico and Canada.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to some transportation people over at CEI, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which is generally a, you know, I don't want to speak for the institute, but there's quite a few people there who are bullish about Trump, and it's not hard to understand why, because they work on regulation and they think that he's going to be rolling it back. But one of the guys was saying, hey, look, he can do all this deregulation stuff. He can allow for kind of a Bob Poole Nirvana world of public-private partnerships to happen in transportation, investment, and this kind of thing. But if you have a trade war, and then also if you have a sudden freak out about, oh my God, we can't let Australians own a toll road because we know the Australians, that will overwhelm the good that can come up with it. Your question, Steve King, does he represent something? He clearly does. And he's been around for a while. The cantaloupe comment, I think it was from 2-3 years ago. He's a key figure in Iowa politics. Iowa matters, obviously, in presidential politics. So everybody has to come and kiss Steve King's ring. Rand Paul was kissing Steve King's ring in Iowa. And he has this feeling, which is shared by a lot of people who are identified self or otherwise with the alt-right, but they make a cultural argument about immigration and assimilation. And a great irony of this that I keep trying to point out is they're always pointing to Europe as the problem of, see, look, those people just aren't assimilating. They're committing all these crimes and everything else. They are not differentiating between the assimilation machine that we have in the United States and the assimilation problems in Western Europe. By using Western Europe as the example of what we don't want to become, they are unwittingly making us become more like Western Europe by essentializing ethnicity. I mean, he said we don't get to freedom or whatever the good place is by through other people's babies. What the living Christ does other people's babies mean? It has long been understood in normal conservative orthodoxy and Ronald Reaganism and whatnot that one of the key selling points of the geniuses of the American experiment is that we are not a nation state. That's one of the very few free countries in the world that is not defined by, do you speak this language? Do you have this religion? Do you have this ethnicity? No, we're based on an idea. And what he is trying to do is essentialize the ethnic component of it as being central to that idea. There's a lot of people, a lot of conservatives, a lot of social conservatives. And right now, even as we're speaking, Ross Douthat, however you pronounce his last name, the New York Times is sort of trying to talk about why social conservatives in particular are becoming fertile to these kind of Steve Kingian ideas. They're becoming pessimistic about the ability to assimilate and all these kind of stuff. And I appreciate what he's trying to do, but at some point it is apologia. This is a really rank attitude, and it's an attitude that has been embraced by people like Jeff Sessions in the Senate, a little bit more politely done, but that's still what he's always been talking about here. Ann Coulter, people who look at our immigration flows and just point to it and say, this is too Asian, this is too brown, this is too Muslim, this is too Mexican. We've had this periodically in American history. That side eventually we all come to be embarrassed by in retrospect. And it's happening in real time right now, not just in weird congressional districts in Iowa, but in the White House. And it's something that we should trace and ultimately reject. It's not what makes us who we are. On the flip side of it, and just really quickly, I think that people should also make proactive arguments about immigration that are realistic. And I don't think Democrats right now Democrats are actually getting close to the open borders caricature that they've always had. They're like, legalize everybody. Everyone's a dreamer. I think in terms of a political conversation, that's not necessary. And also, you can't be a guest worker. So everyone has a path to citizenship. It all has to be this way. I don't think that's a particularly helpful way to engage people on these ideas. These are arguments that need to be fought vigorously, and we've been doing it reason for God knows 20 years at least. But it's on us right now. These people have power.
Well, if I can put a pitch in for something I wrote a few years ago for the magazine when the Great Gatsby movie was coming out, the Baz Luhrmann update. I had written years ago an essay about The Great Gatsby, which is published in 1925, and it actually as a novel about immigrant America. And in the teens and 20s, obviously, there was the vast from 1880 until about 1920-25, there was a vast flow of new types of people who did not speak English, who did not eat American foods, who did not worship a Protestant God, flowing into the cities in the United States. And that's where most of our immigration laws came from. And if you read the Great Gatsby, it's really a novel about America being taken over by immigrants. And the white people, Nick Carraway, Jay Gatsby, the Buchanans, Daisy, and her husband, Tom, they retreat from the East Coast and the messy multi-ethnic cities to the safe space of the industrial Midwest. That's my Midwest, those rolling fields of the Republic. Nick Carraway talks about at the end of the book where people gather in Chicago's train station and talk about all of the famous, fabulous Christmas parties they're going to at the large homes of people with American names. So, Matt, this is an ongoing issue. And one of the ironies for me is that now the people who are the descendants of the immigrants in The Great Gatsby, whose names are literally made fun of in a very famous passage of the book for being too Italian or too Jewish and pretending to be pretending to be Southern or really American. Many of those people now their descendants are saying the same thing about the new immigrants, and it's disturbing to me in the extreme, partly because of that that it's just repeating itself. One of the questions I think that is worth asking is that immigration, large flows of immigration into America, and this happened a couple times in the 19th century as well as in the 20th, they were followed by timeouts, and some people talk about this. The Depression in World War II created a long timeout, and then the rebuilding of Europe, where immigrants or people foreign-born as a percentage of the American population was at its historic low in 1970. It was only about 5%, and then it ramps up again. And I think one of the challenges for those of us or for someone like me who believes in essentially open borders, if you want to come here and you are not a criminal and you want to work, we should find a place for you. That's actually echoing a line Rand Paul said a few years ago. But we need to also figure out ways to convince people that are terrified by, novelty of new types of people coming in and the culture shifting, I think always in better ways, how to be comfortable with that without that long time out. that people dream about, which typically comes about because of economic depression or war or some other kind of horrible activity. Catherine, on this topic, Shikha Dalmia, who writes for us, did a piece recently a couple months ago in the magazine that talked about the new threat here, of course, are Muslims coming to America, even though they make up something like 0.1% of the population. She looked at Dearborn, Michigan, and Hamtramck, the two most majority Muslim cities in America, in the rotting hulk that is Michigan. What did she find? And is that do you expect that to give any kind of aid and comfort to people who are freaking their shit over the idea that new types of people are coming to America?
So in these two cities, she looked at Dearborn, where it's been a sort of long period of Arab and Muslim immigration. It's a place where those cultures have been established and settled for a long time. And Hamtramck, which has sort of changed more recently and also has a more diverse Muslim population. Pretty much anybody who's hailing from anywhere, even remotely Muslim, is represented there. And one thing that she found that was super striking to me was before 9/11, Dearborn was trending incredibly Republican, that it looked like American Muslims were going to be kind of like Cubans. They were going to be a sort of values-oriented, small business-oriented, Republican immigrant community. And all of that changed, of course, after people were radicalized, both Americans and the Muslims themselves, by the way that 9/11 played out. But what she found was that there was a sort of comforting sort of standard pettiness to the Muslim majority city council in Hamtramck, for instance, where they just were fighting the same dumb wars about land use and what kind of pets you can keep in certain zoned areas, that kind of thing. So I think her portrait of people who saw and continue to see greater differences sort of amongst themselves and amongst their sort of private petty concerns, rather than differentiating themselves against the general American population, I found to be quite reassuring. The other thing that Shikha has written about, both in that piece and elsewhere, though, is about the ways that people become radicalized when they perceive that they are under assault. And it's a very gentle version of the backlash theory, but I think it was a lot easier to say to American Muslims, hey, we still perceive you as Americans, chill out. You still have due process. You still have protection of the law. It's easier to say that when you don't have elected representatives saying essentially your children are not really Americans. When you don't have the president saying your relatives are such a threat to our country that they cannot even travel here under any circumstances. It's a lot harder to make the case that we're good at assimilation, and I think we should strive to be good at assimilation. We should be proud of that. I'm also just going to chip in here on the King quote that I think it's so creepy to think of babies as the property of the nation. Like, who's – they're not our babies or their babies. Or it's like they're not like a thing to put in our kind of accounting column of property of the United States with little stamps on their foreheads or something. And I just find that element of nationalism to be particularly odd coming from the mouth of someone like
him. I suspect that all of us have had variations on this. I can remember when my older son was born. This was in 93. It might have been in 94 when this happened. But it was born in L.A., and I was walking down the street with him in a stroller in our neighborhood, and a guy stopped who I didn't know, and he was an older white guy, and he was like, oh, it's great to see a white baby. and I was just like, you don't want to be, hey, old man, go fuck yourself. But it was, I was just kind of taken aback by that. And I suspect all cultures have that. It strikes me as it's absolutely only countries or people who feel there is a decline happening And it deeply offensive, I mean, for an infinite number of reasons. And I agree with you, Catherine. When the Steve King stuff, he's a buffoon and an idiot, but then there is something so unfathomably dark in the mind of a person who feels that way. And I, having said that and read him out of a polite conversation, I strive for a way to, you know, to kind of reach people like that, because I know I have pictures of my mother, who was the daughter of Italian immigrants and was born in 1927. And you look at her now, and it's, I mean, she, by the end of her life, she was as fucking American as Betsy Ross, but she didn't speak English until she went to school, and she looked very Italian. And then, very dusky, very dark, I mean, just cartoonishly an Italian American born in a country which was not necessarily, I mean, which was restricting the ingress of Italians. And, you know, by the end of her life, she was so American that people wouldn't even know that she was Italian, because we had perceived things differently. And I just wish that we could get to have a conversation about how assimilation happens, how it is still happening, how acculturation happens also, how America changes in good ways when it expands to open up more possibilities. What the hell is wrong with having one more option to choose as an ethnic or a cultural identity or a social identity, because the things that come here are actually generally good. People don't come from bad, you know, places they would rather not live to dump their shit on us. They come here to mix and move forward and create something totally new in a kind of beautiful international alchemy. I mean, where, you know, and this goes back to Jean Crèvecoeur's Letters from an American Farmer, written in the 1790s. You know, what then is this American? He's French, he's Dutch, he's German, he's this, he's that. And from that, from these base metals, yeah, I think is even the exact quote, you know, something better is formed. Matt, you have, why don't you take us out with this? I mean, you have daughters who are part, you know, who are, have French and American parentage. And I think even more than Catherine and I apologize, Catherine, for speaking to you, you are truly American in the sense that you don't have any grandparents who didn't speak English or anything like that. How are your kids holding up? And, you know, how does it feel like that? I mean, in a way, you have children who are simultaneously more American than any, because they're immigrant, they're part, you know, they have immigrant blood in them directly, but also they're super American. I mean, what, you know, where do you come down on these types of topics?
It's kind of funny. I mean, my heart on these topics is, you know, I'm a full cosmetarian assimilationist, go America, obviously, but I also live in neighborhood in a city, in a borough in a city in Brooklyn, where we live there because of a French American public school, or a public school that's really good, that has two immersion French classes from kindergarten to fifth grade, which is great. So my daughters can learn French grammar, because it's always very difficult to learn your mother tongue, or, you know, exotic tongues grammar when you live in a dominant English place. So that's wonderful. But it also has sort of helped create this neighborhood where you hear this goddamn frogs all over the place. I mean, there's people with sweaters around their neck, you know, playing not bocce ball, but petanque.
A boule.
So it's very funny. And but also the politics of the moment are such that at the public school, they're completely freaking out over Trump and sending out messages, you know, to our immigrant parents, you know, we stand in solidarity, we'll never rat you out. And so my oldest daughter, who's now eight, she already has the kind of skeptical eye, like, you know what, Donald Trump may be a big fat baby. That's her words, not mine. But people are being a little bit hysterical here. Like, everyone's worried that they're going to be deported from school. And it's just, I mean, these are people who, some of them are citizens of the United States. It doesn't make any sense. And the kind of nonstop sort of shrieking that's happening in the neighborhood, she's raising a skeptical eyebrow over. But the longer arc of it all is genuinely distressing for me, because I've seen this play out before especially in Central Europe in the 1990s, this kind of politics. I have seen it, witnessed it, covered it almost to the exact words that Donald Trump and Sean Spicer and other people have used. You know, make Slovakia great again, I'm pretty sure was a phrase from Vladimir Mečiar's gang. And they were similarly obsessed, you know, with the shadowy elites from foreign capitals and all of that. And I just have seen it, and it doesn't end well. It ends very badly. And it makes me genuinely sad on some level, or at least it did at first when it started happening. I've kind of moved through my stages of grief on it and realized, look, we just have an argument on our hands. That's all. To your point about Steve King, Nick, you, in order to be in the business of persuading people, you have to actually talk to them and address whatever they're getting at, not just throw up your hands and say, my God, we live amongst monsters. This is terrible. I just find that approach, even while I think Steve King should be sent on the slow boat to Mauritius and kept there probably, despite all that, I think that we have to find ways to talk to people who otherwise are saying things that we don't agree with.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I transgress the line there of you're never going to win people over by talking about their unfathomably dark inhuman heart. Catherine, do you think a lot of these problems will solve? You know, and this is popular, I think, certainly among libertarian analysts, but people at large, that you know what we're really dealing with here is not it has nothing to do with ethnicity or immigration or even terrorism. It's about economic growth, and that for the past umpteen years, we've had sub 2% annual growth, and if we can crack 3% or 4%, a lot. You know what we're dealing with here is people kind of fighting over a pie that is not growing or might even be shrinking in real terms. Do you think that will fix all issues?
I'm not sure economic growth will fix all issues. I think the question of employment levels is probably more central. It's good when people feel richer because their house is worth a little more, or their 401k is worth a little more. But this particular manifestation of economic anxiety with regard to immigration and whose babies are whose is much more, to my mind, about the level of joblessness. And, you know, there I'm basically just looking forward to a horrific transition in which we stop scapegoating Mexicans and start scapegoating robots.
Yes.
So I think we can probably go straight to that if we time it right, which will be better for Mexicans and worse for all of us overall, since, as you know, I welcome our robot overlords.
Well, and then when the robots gain consciousness, we're really screwed. But, when we start trashing Flippy, the hamburger flipping machine that's being unveiled in fast food restaurants around the country, but when Flippy's kids gain consciousness, I think we're going to have a lot to answer for.
But you know what? Flippy's kids are dreamers, man. Like they were, they're born here. They're real Americans, just like you and me.
Well, that is going to be when Steve King 2.0 is talking about whose prototypes are these? They're the nation's prototypes, the half human, half robots that are being birthed in 2025 or something. Well, we will leave it there. I want to thank Catherine Mangu Ward of Reason Magazine. Catherine, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
And Matt Welch, as always, editor-at-large of Reason. Matt, from your Brooklyn outpost, your Brooklyn spider hole, thank you for talking.
Hashtag resist.
And I'm Nick Gillespie, and this has been the Reason Podcast. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and go to Reason.com and check out all of our writing. You can also subscribe to the print magazine there for $15 a year for 11 great issues. Thanks so much.